maybe I'll just use that to say right off the bat, I am here on sabbatical, and so what I have to say is my own views and doesn't necessarily represent the views of the organization that I work for, which is QP, as Stephanie says, Canadian Union of Public Employees. So with that out of the way, let me start, but I've prepared a fair bit, and I have a case I'd like to make, and this is really, I'm kind of at early stages of a research project on some of these issues. So some of what I have to prepare to present is really, it's intended to be provocative and a set of questions. I don't claim to have, you know, something worked out and definitive answers, but I hope it'll lead to an interesting discussion, and I appreciate the discussants who've agreed to respond and engage. So my plan for what I'd like to present, I'm going to start with a couple of slides. I'm assuming that not everyone is a pension person, and so, but some people may be. So I'm going to do very brief highlights of some pension history that I think is relevant for the later discussion. So a couple of slides on pension history. And then I'm going to talk about how the labor movement has approached the issue and the challenge of pensions and retirement income, the whole need for something, some way to live after you stop working, which is has been an evolving debate and discussion for decades and goes back to the 19th century. And then the real heart of the discussion will be the next section, which where I want to talk about what I think is a fundamental contradiction or a fundamental set of challenges in fact, how the labor movement has answered some of these questions and strategized, and which then leads to a final bit about possible alternative directions. But that's where it gets even more kind of open-ended and less definitive. So that's my plan. And I probably prepared a little too much, so forgive me if I move a little too quickly or you find I'm skipping some stuff. So the problematic here, well, the title of the talk that we worked out, Whose Class Power Do Pension Funds Represent? I came up with that with the intention of being a bit provocative, because I think if you just think about it in the abstract today, I think a lot of trade unions, a lot of us in the labor movement, are deeply attached to the pension plans and the pension benefits that we have and that we fought for, that many of us fought for over many years. And so at one level, it's a kind of a simple legacy of past struggles, union struggles, some of us would say class struggles, that have borne fruit and made a critical material difference in many workers' lives. So at one level, you could see pensions that exist, both workplace-level pensions and public pensions, as a success, as a residue of past class struggles, and so in some ways a representative of working-class power. But I want to investigate that a little further, and that's really the setup for the discussion that I want to get to, because I don't think it's that simple. Even though a lot of us in the labor movement, a lot of authors and writers who talk about, especially today, about pensions and pension funds as investment vehicles, I think there is a bit of a glazing over of some key contradictions that are not discussed enough and need some interrogation and investigation. So that's the problem I want to get to. So some history to set this up. Where do pensions come from? How long have they been with us? And how did we end up with the complicated structure that we have today? Just a few points quickly. It's interesting because I haven't studied enough of the sort of the ancient history. I'm learning that pensions, what we call pensions today in some form, actually, people have traced it to millennia of history, of some kind of commitments to pay people some money on a regular basis, sometimes for life. In the form, though, that we think of today as sort of a life payment that starts at a certain point and is paid for life, it's really interesting. I'm learning that it really arose in a lot of ways with the rise of capitalism. In other words, in the 17th and 18th century, you started to see these commitments. But in many ways, and in their original form, pensions were made, and this is in the history of Britain, England, and France, they were something that was paid to public servants, senior officials, and friends of a nobility, very small number, fractional, and really marginal economically. It wasn't until the 19th century, really, that you started to have, with the arrival of a large working class that no longer had previous supports and social structures and family structures and peasant economic structures to support themselves economically, that you had a whole bunch of workers increasingly living in cities that would work and then reach a point where they were no longer able to physically or as a result of age or whatever, and they had nothing to fall back on. So the labor movement and working class movements in the 19th century started to identify this as a need and a priority. And, you know, I'm just going to go very quickly. I think many people will know that while a few pensions started to get established in places like the UK, United States, even in Canada, the 19th century, really wasn't until Bismarck, it was a turning point, late 19th century, established a state system to provide a minimal pension to essentially everyone that was identified as entitled. And this has all kinds of gender and other social dimensions that need to be looked at. But that was a turning point, which then led to several decades of struggle for more of that in other countries, and also struggles that were based on the workplace. You started to see the emergence of a divide between where should pension commitments or retirement income commitments come from? Should they come from the state, or should they come from where we work? And I'll just, you know, flag very briefly that with the arrival of the initial state-based systems, you know, Bismarck and then, you know, the 1908 in the UK and then Beveridge and the expansion of these things, there was immediately a counter-pressure against it, a resistance to it, led by some employers and businesses, but particularly the financial sector that had already been established by that time, who saw this as potentially threatening, especially state-based programs. So continuing with the history, I want to just flag, and I'm jumping forward, in terms of where we've ended up today, I would identify the post-war period, the immediate post-war period, as a critical turning point in this specific sense. So there were struggles. We know about the struggles over in the United States, to some extent in Canada, over the economic crisis of the 30s, the need for social programs, welfare state, pensions, unemployment insurance. In many ways, pensions are a kind of form of unemployment insurance when you think about it. It's interesting to draw the connections between the struggles for those two things. But in the post-war period, in the immediate post-war period, it's a very interesting period that I would like to study more. In all of the, and again, I'm narrowing a lot of my focus to the UK, United States, Canada, which is sort of where a lot of these things got hashed out, there were very significant pressures for not only the establishment of Social Security, eventually the United States, and similar programs with Beveridge in the wartime period in the UK, and then what eventually became our old age security system in Canada, kind of crystallized in 1952, there was a strong pressure for establishing European-style, decent state-based programs. And the labor movement had interesting views about this. In fact, and just to focus specifically on the United States-based labor movement, there were different views about it, and in surprising divisions. The AFL-CIO, or the AFL, for example, and Gompers, one of the early leaders of the labor movement there, was not enthusiastic about a state-based system because he immediately identified pensions. It's a bit like health insurance, right, when you think about it, as something that unions could organize, establish, maybe even run and administer, and advance their sort of raison d'etre and control, and also establish loyalty and commitment to the union itself as opposed to some other body. So there was a politics there. Other unions, and I'll name specifically the UAW as an important player in this, took a political and policy position, which, you know, frankly, in retrospect, I'm very sympathetic to. They said, no, we want an expansion of Social Security. We want a public-based system that would be sufficient. A key turning point emerged in around the late 40s, 1949, 1950, when interestingly, in the history that I've studied, and I'd like to learn it more, Ford and GM took a turn on the issue and decided to go to the UAW bargaining in those years and negotiate a workplace-based funded pension system for their workers only, for workers of those companies only. And I think they had tried this in 45 and the UAW rejected it. But in 1950, 49-50, after some conflict about it, it was conceded. It was accepted. And it was a major program. And I won't even comment on all of there's a bunch of dynamics, a bit of which I know, some of which I don't. I'm not even comment that much on it. But I think it was a key turning point because if you look at the statistics, and I don't have it all in a chart, but from that point on, the whole model, the GM, UAW model of workplace-based, funded or investment-secured pension programs exploded. In the 3, 4, 5 years after that, it extended to all kinds of major industries in the United States. This had huge spillover effects into Canada. And in many ways, this sort of dual model, very much North American or Anglo-Saxon, this dual model of a minimal public system supplemented by a more substantial workplace-based and asset-secured or funded supplemental pension arrangement that was workplace-based was established. And that's essentially the model that we still have today. Just very quickly, Canada, I mentioned the OAS in 1952, very minimal, basic, state-based, general revenue-funded system that has no fund, but Canada established the Canada Pension Plan in 1966. This is a bit of a latecomer compared to other countries. Also very crucial, but minimal. It's intended to replace only 25% of average wages for people when they retire. And so, again, that fit together with old age security and I should add, the original proposal, and this is relevant for today, the original proposal from the labor movement and other advocates of retirement income was for a CPP program that would be twice as large, that would actually replace 50% of average industrial wages. That was what the labor movement proposed. There was a ferocious counter-pressure against that from, guess who, the banking industry, the insurance industry, and many large employers that said, no, we don't need a big state system like that. We will do it. We will do it ourselves. Let's keep building on this model that came out of the 50s. And so they ended up compromising. Well, they cut it in half. And that was a key turning point again in the Canadian history. And the plan was for labor, was to then continue to try to extend this model to all workers. And I'll just say very briefly, how did that go? It's interesting to look at the history of the extension of workplace-based pension coverage, these supplemental plans across the economy. And this, I know the Canadian numbers better than any other. We ended up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and it was, to some extent, we had successes. This was the rise of unions, the expansion of unions into the public sector, collective bargaining rights, and so forth. And so pension coverage followed, and more workplaces started to have it. But it never ended up even a majority. We ended up going from 20 to 30 to 40% of workers covered, and it actually peaked out at 45% of workers covered by these supplemental plans. That means the rest essentially left to only this minimal Canada pension plan and old age security and the guaranteed income supplement and income tested, but basically like poverty protection pensions, nothing beyond. So 45%, that peak was hit in 1991. It's just very interesting for those of you interested in political economy and the history of neoliberalism and the history of finance to think about this time period, because, of course, since 1991, the number has gone down. The attacks on these programs and pensions have been ferocious. So that whole deal that, you know, the finance and employers saying, yeah, we're going to extend it to everybody, they kind of decided against that in the early 90s with the whole shift of political economy. And we've been on the defensive ever since. And as everybody knows, in the last 5 years since the great financial crisis, the attacks have been colossal. We are in now an unprecedented period of attacks. We are losing these things. Those of us that work in the labor movement, I've got a colleague from CAW Unifor, this is not even an open secret anymore. This is just reality. And there is, I don't think anybody claiming that we're on the cusp of turning that around. A little bit like union density, which is not coincidental. I just to add briefly, Benjamin may add to this, I want to emphasize, but I don't have a lot on it because I want to get to other things. I say that pension coverage did expand and improve, and this was really important for the history, but we have to be really aware that this was workplace and earnings-based, and so this had all kinds of implications for which workers get covered, which workers end up with improved retirement security. This has all kinds of gender implications, implications for workers of color and immigrant workers and others who face all kinds of discrimination problems in the labor market, the wage market, and so forth. That's a whole discussion that is worth investigation, which is partly what I understand Benjamin is doing, and just needs to be recognized. And I'll just add a couple of other bits to. I'm taking too much on the history, but it's, you know, it's interesting history. I'll just wrap up with a couple of last observations about this more recent period. A couple of key dimensions to the crisis and the attacks. One of them is that, as people will know, one of the key bits of grist for the right-wing attacks is that pensions have come to be identified as a bastion of privilege for especially public sector workers who have these wonderful pensions. And the right-wing emphasizes the gap and the significance of the gap between the minority of workers who have these things and the majority who don't. And they use that as evidence for why we need to rein all of this in. Why should you, as a taxpayer that doesn't have a pension, help to fund the pensions of public sector workers who end up, you know, there's all kinds of distortions and exaggerations. But there is some facts in this, too. It is true. So that's a key bit. And secondly, I just want to emphasize the another form the attacks are taking inside workplaces, both private sector and public sector, and Kara and I know this very well, is a lot of employers are proposing what we call two-tier structures. In other words, cutting off newly hired workers or workers below a certain age from the pension coverage. Or workers that are defined in precarious ways, part-time workers, temporary, casual, this hugely expanding section, well, they're cut out, right? And I'll say, you know, those of us in the labor movement, it's very difficult, these forms of attack, and it is dividing and splitting our own membership, and potentially, I would just add editorially, with my QP hat off, I think if unions concede to this direction of things, it is potentially suicidal for trade unions to end up with these kinds of splits. I'm just going to add, because it is relevant, another key little change. Not so little. I think it's huge, but it was under-recognized and we didn't respond sufficiently, I think, in the labor movement. In 1998, people may recall that the Canada Pension Plan, Paul Martin under the Liberal government at the time, did a number of reforms to the Canada Pension Plan. This basically means cuts to benefits, cuts to disability pensions, and cuts that basically had disproportionate effects on women, low-income workers, and workers with disabilities. That's a side point. One of the other aspects of those changes was a fundamental change to the investment policy of the Reserve Fund. And there's a whole thing here I'd like to say more about, maybe I'll add afterwards, but that Reserve Fund at the time was only a cushion. It's a pay-as-you-go plan for the most part. So it's not funded in the way that workplace plans are normally. But nonetheless, it had $40 billion at the time. And the investment program from 1966, its establishment, these funds were used to loan funds to the provincial governments that wanted to expand public infrastructure. So a lot of the hospitals and highways and universities and other things that provincial governments did from 1966 on were in some ways funded out of those revenues, not exclusively, but this was a huge, important source of cheap funding for these key publicly initiated and often governed or controlled infrastructure projects. I will get back to this because this is not what's happening today. The change to the CPP Reserve Fund investment program was to move it to a much larger fund rather than one representing 2 years of annual benefits, 5 years. And all of it, in the newly acquired assets, would be invested normally in the financial markets like a normal private sector pension plan, which means the stock and bond markets. Well, initially it was thought to be the stock and bond markets, but now it has morphed into the whole array of emerging financial instruments, financial structures, financial investments, private equity, infrastructure, private infrastructure, and so forth. And that fund was $40 billion in 98. It's now $190 billion in that fund, which, in fact... The history is interesting and important. It's hard to understand the other stuff without it. But anyway, I'll tack on. Actually, I'm going to skip this slide mostly. Let me just say the accumulation of privately invested pension funds. So now I'm talking about the combination of all those workplace funds that ended up negotiated securing those workplace plans, plus the CPP Reserve Fund that's now so expanded. If you add up all those funds today in one big asset pile, we're talking about, I've seen different estimates, somewhere between $1.1 and $1.3 trillion in financial assets. Put that into a larger perspective, I just saw an OECD report saying if you put all the pension funds, these kinds of privately invested pension funds of the OECD into one pile, we're talking about $20 trillion. In financial assets. So it is an enormous component of the larger structure of financial assets today. Okay, with 10 minutes, I'm going to go sort of very quickly. I'm probably going to skip a bit of this because the second point I wanted to make is how have trade unions, what has been our attitude towards not just these plans, but specifically the guiding question I want to look at is how did we view these funds? At how they're invested and how they should be invested, and this sort of strange, almost peculiar aspect of having this portion of our wages, sort of a deferred wage, ending up contingent and wrapped up in financial instruments and financial investment structures. What was our view? I'll kind of be a bit sweeping to go through it quickly. I'll say, by and large, for the first decades, I think what I've seen is most unions accepted that the investment of these funds was to be assigned to the banks and brokerage houses, insurance companies, and other specialists who had already established all of their expertise in doing this, and so that would just continue as per normal. In the U.S., they established what are called Taft-Hartley funds, even in the 40s, where there was some union representation on governing bodies that would oversee this. But my sense, I'd like to learn more, is that even in those funds, they were invested normally. In other words, the unions didn't really have an alternative agenda for how they might be invested. But this did change, at least, especially, I'll speak to Canada, trim it back just to Canada. In Canada, I would say mainly in the 1980s and into the 90s, a number of unions, especially in the public sector, where these plans were contributory, this is one difference I can't get into, but in the private sector, a lot of pension plans funded by the employer. There were no contributions flowing from the member. That gives you a bit of a different attitude towards this question of who owns the funds and who should control them and invest. In the public sector, they were mostly co-funded, often on a 50-50 basis, sometimes a differential basis, but there was this more direct sense, well, that's our money, and then maybe we should be controlling. And then when you find out how they're invested, some unions developed an agenda that said we should be jointly controlling these things. We should be jointly overseeing the management of the plans and decision-making around the plans' benefits, but also the investments. We would like to have some say over these things. And certainly the union that I work for, QP, and a number of the other public sector unions in Canada definitely developed that view. What was the investment agenda? And I'm going to trim off the other agendas around fights over surplus and benefit improvements and all that stuff. That kind of is part of the picture. But there was an investment side agenda, but my basic case is it was not exactly fleshed out or carefully thought through and constructed or even articulated, I would say, in many ways. What you often see, if you look back at stuff, even stuff that was produced by QP from the 1980s and 90s, you'd have, a kind of a vague notion that these things should be invested in socially responsible ways. And you had, along the same time, the arrival of something called the socially responsible investment movement, which also emerged in mutual funds. And a lot of trade unionists were sort of sympathetic to this idea that investment funds, pension investment funds, should be somehow invested in ways that reflect the values and principles of the labor movement and workers' interests. But there wasn't a lot of investigation about how simple and straightforward that would be. Where are we at? We're getting on, you know. Just that point is what I want to investigate, because whether or not this was clearly articulated and the investment agenda of the various unions keen on this was clear, we did end up negotiating and winning some forms of joint control or co-management, or what sometimes is called joint trusteeship, or even minority representation on these kinds of boards, and unions started to name people to represent them on boards, including boards that oversee investment policy. A key turning point in this piece of the story is 1990. 1990 is when the Ontario government negotiated with the Ontario Teachers Federation for a restructuring of the teachers' pension plan that had been long established into a kind of joint control or joint governance, very debatable. And that set a pattern, which then was followed in the hospital sector, the Ontario Public Service, and eventually the municipal school board pension plan called OMERS. All of these, in fact, I would say majority of the large public sector plans in Ontario specifically were moved to some form of joint governance with trade unions involved and overseeing them. And there was an acceptance, I would say, of a key principle of how these funds had always been viewed from a legal perspective. And that is that while we have this agenda of, you know, kind of investment in the interests of workers and with social responsibility, there was also this acceptance, I would say, for the most part, of the idea that, well, but they are also covered by this legal principle of fiduciary duty. And fiduciary duty basically means, is interpreted by pension lawyers to suggest that if you are a controller of trust property, you have a legal obligation to represent the interest of the beneficiaries. And the way that has been translated legally, for the most part, is their financial interest. And to be very crude about it, how that gets translated into the investment world is, your legal obligation is to seek to maximize the rate of return that you generate on your investments, regardless of how they get generated. So there's a tension, obviously, in this idea. Well, in fact, my main argument really. Because there's not just a tension, but there's actually a fundamental contradiction there between the idea that we can have our cake and eat it too. We can establish new investment policies that will be socially progressive and respectful of workers, respectful of the environment, and you can add to that. But at the same time, aim to maximize the rate of return. And I really think we really need to investigate that basic argument or principle, I would argue contradiction, far more deeply and seriously than what has happened so far. I'll skip this. I think I've covered, yeah. So the last key section here is, as I started to say, I'd like to identify further the way I see this contradiction, this fundamental contradiction here, playing out today and in recent years. I put in my slide six different contradictions. I think it's really one contradiction with multiple aspects. And I'm going to try to work through these very quickly so as not to take up too much time. The first contradiction or aspect of this contradiction is goes back really to what I described in the history as this split or this strategic decision to accept or get forced to concede the idea that rather than the labor movement fighting for decent retirement income security, decent pensions for all workers, for the entire working class, we'll do it on a workplace-based basis. I think even without getting into the financial side, we are seeing today, I think, the long-term implications of that, because what we ended up with was a bifurcation or a key split in the working class itself. And so the idea that, you know, let's be honest, today, those of us, especially in the public sector, private sector too, when we appeal for support from the broad public and fellow workers for the defense, the strategic and collective bargaining, or other defense of our pensions, that's difficult. It's especially difficult, and this is a point that I'll throw in, that Sam Gindin makes, I think, in a very provocative but very persuasive way. A point he made recently is this. He said, maybe we could do that. We could make those appeals in a situation like maybe we had in the 50s and 60s when there was economic growth, extension of union rights, and there was this notion that, well, we will fight for it first and it will gradually extend. We will lift all boats, right? When you could make that case, then I think you could make that argument with workers, right? Today, as Sam says, and I agree fully, we can't make that case anymore. I don't think we can credit, we can try. And we can certainly say, well, but we're trying to extend coverage to all workers, but we're not. We are failing even with our own members. We're losing coverage, at least secure coverage. So I think that's a hugely important strategic point that Sam makes, and it relates to this original contradiction. I would suggest that also, and I guess maybe this really connects to the second point I want to make. It's not just the coverage question, it's also how we are doing it. The idea that we will secure, I mean, it's a very interesting thing that I think we have to wrestle with. The idea that we will secure workers' wages, workers' economic security at a certain point in their lives, essentially through the financial system, through storing up, through setting aside and deferring current wages, putting them into the financial system to then grow and provide a basis for later consumption. When you think about it at a very aggregated and macro level, what is, I mean, certainly from a political economy perspective, what is that that you're doing? You're putting that finance into the system to extract surpluses from the accumulation process and consume it. Well, how is that accumulation process going? And is it ultimately, I guess here's the question, is that something that ultimately can be extended to all workers? And I think I would argue that some of the ugly things that pension funds are doing today reflect that contradiction and that it's sort of a fallacy of composition, I would argue. Because what you have today, and I'm sort of skipping points here, but what you have today is, and if you look at what especially these largest jointly governed pension funds are doing today, they're increasingly, rather than as they did in decades past, investing passively in bonds, government bonds, corporate bonds, maybe some stock securities and equities, but holding them passively to collect dividends. No. Today, in the last 20 years, last 10 years, what pension funds are doing has been revolutionized, along with what is happening in the financial system. The arrival of hedge funds, the arrival of derivative markets, the arrival of private equity, leveraged buyout structures to buy up companies. I've got a whole bunch of stuff that I could reference here, but I'll leave it to later maybe. But the pension fund, I'll say this, the pension fund that I look at in investment terms most closely is actually OMERS, this municipal school board plan in Ontario. It holds $60 billion. I look at teachers too, OMERS and teachers. But I'll just talk about OMERS for a second. OMERS, this pension fund of QP members and public sector workers, it has become, I would suggest, the lead financial initiator of what we call public-private partnerships in infrastructure. So privately owned schools, public schools in Nova Scotia, the Highway 407, a toll highway, the P3 hospitals in Ontario, public-private, so the privatization of our hospital system is something that our own pension funds are now deeply implicated in and extracting surpluses from. This is dramatically different than this old passive collection of interest-bearing capital and dividends and so forth. This is pension funds actually becoming, I would argue, predatory. David Harvey, actually, throw this in. David Harvey points out that, in this recent neoliberal period where you have privatization playing such a critical role and the financial sector central to that, he argues that this is almost a different regime or system of accumulation that he says is can be characterized as accumulation by dispossession, like the older periods of primitive accumulation and other forms of dispossession that got capitalism going. Well, my goodness, if our own pension funds are implicated in this, and they are, especially the largest, including the Canada Pension Plan, OMERS, teachers, there's a whole list that is just very disturbing and flies in the face of the trade unions' earlier ambition of trying to make sure that these funds would be invested in socially progressive ways that reflect workers' interests. Stephanie's saying wrap up, so I'm going to just quickly make sure I've covered, I haven't missed out. Okay, there's 2 points I'll just quickly say. This, what I'm pointing out is contentious, I would suggest. And this is one of the reasons that I'm taking advantage of my sabbatical leave to pursue this, because in the labor movement, including in particular the public sector labor movement, there is, as I say, not only the pension plans and benefits, but even these governance structures with union representation, these are sources of pride for the unions. And this is, again, a fundamental contradiction. What I'm saying is this leaves us often in a situation where, as unions, we're not really wanting to talk about these embarrassing pictures of what how the pension funds are generating their surpluses. And this is something that we're actually implicated in and at times, I would argue, helping to cover up or helping to conceal or worse, by at times calling it socially responsible investment, we're actually giving it a friendly gloss. We're making it look good, not very different from people will know about corporate social responsibility programs, where large corporations want to boast that they're now socially responsible because they give to charity or whatever. Well, pension funds are using that in much the same way. And I would argue, if we're not careful, trade unions and union representatives may end up in this same trap. Final point, and I will wrap up. So that sort of at least puts it on the table. I have more dimensions to this, but maybe we can get into it in discussion. But to sort of wrap up, I would like to say, so I'm trying to put a problematic, a contradiction, and a strategic challenge onto the table for discussion. A lot of people will say, okay, so what's your solution? How do we fix this? How do we resolve this? And this is not, obviously, this is not easy or straightforward, particularly at a time when the labor movement is in massive retreat and facing defeat after defeat. You know, launching a new strategic reorientation is, tall order on anything, let alone something so fundamental as this. But nonetheless, it's worth asking the question, so what would we do differently? What I would consider to be a definancialized and decommodified pension strategy look like for the labor movement? And I think there are a couple of things that we can point to. I, first and foremost, would point to that old investment policy. Well, first of all, the simple point is it was a strategic mistake to not continue to advance demands for pension security, retirement security for all workers, including women and other workers who don't have a full career history in the paid labor force. That should have been and should have remained our strategic focus, and it is not always sufficiently. So that's one point. And go back to that CPP old reserve policy. Fund publicly owned and controlled and democratically accountable infrastructure rather than the stripping of public assets and the continuing privatization. I think that would be very good. We have to fight the idea. I argue for definancialization. This is very contentious. A lot of people in the labor movement think we need more investment. We need more pension funds and so forth. I would suggest, and those of you that have studied the rise of finance and what the transformations in the financial system are doing to the modern world under neoliberalism and to workers, I would argue we need to strategize how to rein in and reduce the weight and the predations of the private financial sector. And we're not doing that in the labor movement if we continue on the track that we've always been. That would be one of my arguments. I'll stop there.
Okay, great. Thank you.
I'll stop there. Thank you very much.